That was, of course, Desafinado, and it will be the theme music for this new program. I'm Hans Koning. Why did I pick Desafinado? Well, I think I've always loved the music, but I have a more profound reason. Desafinado, Portuguese, means dissonance, and I want my program to be a dissonant. I'm going to call it Literary Discord. It will be about books and about serious writing and publishing and all that. And it's a discord because I am in an adversary position on most of what you hear and read on the subject. I don't think Cold Mountain was literature, and I don't think Perfume was literature, if you remember those two books from last year. And I don't even think that John Updike or Norman Mailer or even Hemingway were or are great writers. But don't worry, I'm not going to hold forth here by myself in the future. I will make sure that there are others on my program, and most of them, if not all of them, will have an opposite point of view. But anyway, you don't need PKM to hear the usual stuff about bestsellers, bestsellers, bestsellers. That's more for a business program, I've always thought, than about a literary program. I once wrote to the New York Times and told them that most of their book news belonged on the business page. And I think they may actually have taken that to heart because most of the stuff now is on the business page. Okay, what are my credentials to attack all these various imposing buildings of opinion and whatever? My name and the accent I have, and I'm afraid is audible on the microphone, are Dutch, but I'm an American writer. My first novel was The Affair, and it was published by Knopf in 1958. So I have about 40 years hard going behind me. I started out writing under my original Dutch name, Hans Koningsberger, which is a fine Dutch name, but here it was always misspelled. And also it led people to believe or ask me, are you German? And perhaps for the wrong reasons, but people in my generation hate to be asked that, at least if they're Dutch. So all that seemed more practical to abbreviate it to Koning. My only reason I have to bring this up is because I was known once as Koningsberger. If I had done this in time, if my editor at Knopf hadn't been a very old-fashioned, nice gentleman, Henry Robbins, who wouldn't dream of jazzy names or writers' names, I would have started out as Koning, or perhaps even something better. Of course, Koning was, I'm not trying to pass as an Anglo-Saxon, because Koning is just as Dutch as Koningsberger. But like from Simenon to François Sagan, people have used other names to make it easier to be remembered, and I have tried to do this too, if a bit late. Anyway, after The Affair came a lot of other novels. My last one was called Pursuit of a Woman on the Hinge of History. That came out last year, and it was my 12th novel. And I've just finished a new one, which will be called Zeeland. That's a province in Holland, although it's not about that. And that's my novel for the year 2000. And I've written nonfiction books and have written, as a reporter at large for The New Yorker, I've written a biography of Columbus, who was not a hero, but a genocidal maniac, and a whiny one at that, a most unfortunate combination of characters, and a lot more of that stuff. But more relevant, I've had many publishers, including the famous names Farrar, Straus, Simon & Schuster, Knopf, Holt, Harcourt Brace, and I've had many literary agents. Sometimes they gave me the sack, but more often I walked out on them. Publishing here has indeed gone from not so very good to very much worse in those 40 years. And however, I would hope and think and try to believe that it's the more reason to fight back, but it is a fight. When my novel came out, my first novel, The Affair, I did get good reviews, and those reviews were in 8 daily newspapers in New York. Perhaps it was 7 at the point, and they were all serious, and they all influenced the market. Now, of course, the only game in town is the New York Times in the daily papers. So you can see how things in that sense have changed. But above all, in this first program, I must define serious writing. And that's not that easy. It is a thing you really feel in your bones if you believe in the distinctions I make. But obviously there are books which are on one side of the line in one people's mind, and somebody else will think they are across the line. And I must hasten to add that this is not a value judgment I'm talking about. Sort of, we are better than you guys. I have every respect and sometimes jealousy, although really, truly not very often, towards the hardened professionals who turn out these enormous tomes of entertainment. It isn't literature, but that's not what they're trying to write. They would laugh if that was given them as a criticism. They entertain, and they are billionaires, or as near as them it. Last April, there was a week around Easter in this country when 4% of any book changing hands in that period, any book sold, was a book by John Gresham. Now, that's an amazing statistic. That probably has never happened in the history of book publishing. And it isn't that mysterious either. Of course, first of all, there's the enormous media propaganda scene, but also the very simple economics which are now playing such a part in publishing, which is, as you all are aware of probably, owned by fewer and fewer people and a different kind of people. If you have lunch with a publisher nowadays, you do not talk about books, you talk about money. And the guys who have taken over this industry here in our own New York, which was, of course, the largest publishing entity in the world, I would think, they've been taken over. Almost every house has been taken over in one way or another, so that only a few left. But worse than that is the fact that the new people are not the traditional publishers who are more interested in books than in having a big profit made. Traditionally, a publisher in the U.S. made 2 or 3% profit over a year. And that was satisfactory because it enabled him to do books he believed in, and it also gave a good market for popular entertainment. Once a publishing house like that is taken over by a group of people who also run parking lots and laundrettes and make missiles or God knows what else they're all doing, they think in terms of 15 or 20% interest, because they will figure out why all this trouble. If they get 2% interest, that would be ridiculous. So there's a completely different approach. And since a serious novel in the present situation of marketing and distribution will not make these vast profits, they obviously look at different targets. If you a traditional publisher, ideally, I don't mean that they were saints, but they were just thinking in other terms. If he printed, say, 100 titles, and each title would sell from between 1,000 and 10,000 copies, that would be a good showing. And most everybody who could write half a reasonable English would get a chance to be heard. That would be a year for Knopf in the year 1950, say. Nowadays, obviously, if you print 1 million copies of 10 books, you make very much more profit than if you print 10,000 copies of 1,000 books, or even 1,000 copies of 10,000 books, because the cost of the whole thing is that it's not only distribution, but of course also the printing. And it's very simple economics that if you just keep the presses running, there are 1 million books, it costs not much more than print 1,000 books. So it's simply the market which has become dominant in this sense. I don't for a moment think that these guys are evil who want to promote bad stuff, although plenty of them do, but not because it's bad, but because they think it will sell a lot of copies, which unfortunately often happens, of course. So the basic thing is, well, this has become the guideline in publishing. Serious writers are, in my mind, the women and the men who write because they have to. They write what they have to write, and they write what they hear in their own minds. They don't look in the New York Times Book Review what is the bestseller of the week. They don't accept, they don't ask, and they don't accept advice from agents or publishers about what's in and what's out. They write about the human condition. I must say, if I may say about myself, I've never changed a comma unless somebody pointed out that it was the wrong comma. I have never changed because they told me it would be more, it would sell better. My first novel took many years to get published because here I was arriving from Indonesia and not even with English as my mother language. And many publishers gave me good advice about how to change this novel, which actually in the end was published just as I had written it and was in all modesty, very successful, certainly is a critical success, even if it didn't sell very many copies. I've never tried to write a bestseller, and I have very easily succeeded in not ever writing a bestseller. But there you have it. If you either write for yourself or you write to make money, and then if you write with money, then you can be very lucky. Don't think that you can write a bestseller sort of tongue-in-cheek, because you can't. You have to believe in it yourself, in what you're doing. You don't have to believe that it's great literature, but you have to believe that it is something special. No serious writer could say, I need some money, I can't pay the rent, I'm now going to write a bestseller. It does not work. Of course, I must say on the side, bestsellers are to a large degree not written but made. If a book has sort of the necessary ingredients, well, then you can often make it into a bestseller with a lot of value and a lot of publicity. It doesn't always work. In fact, it not works more often than not, but it works enough to keep the system going. Now, when I say that serious writers write about the human condition, I do certainly not mean that they pick noble and elevated subjects, or that they preach, or that they hold forth, or that they tell us how to do this or that, or that they take pleasure in being profound and difficult to understand. You can write about anything you want or need, as long as your writing shows that you owe an awareness of the human mystery, the human comedy, and the human tragedy. If you have that awareness, you can write about somebody's adventures as a car repairman, and it will be fine. And if you don't have it, say Herman Wouk, who did not have it, or does not have it, I don't know if he's still among us, but he could write about the most momentous subject, about the war, about the Pearl Harbor, from Pearl Harbor on, the great dramas of American life, and it was still as flat from a certain point of view, although it may be called a page turner, because everybody knows what happens, but it is not literature. It doesn't touch that golden center. It doesn't mean that you have to be obscure. There are writers who think if they leave out all the commas, they suddenly turn a piece of entertainment or a piece of, forgive the word, trash into literature. No, it does not have to be hard to take. The most splendid literature of the past has survived hundreds of years, or 100 years, or 50 years, and it is truly a delight to read. If you read it for pleasure, if you come upon it, it has largely been ruined for us for whole generations in school, where you have to read it, and you have to then explain it. You have to write a little essay what it's all about, and then you have an academic who, in front of the classroom, who then starts to pick it apart, and to me sounds like a gynecologist who points at the chart of a body cut open and tries to use it to explain romantic love. It's not the way to look at literature. Serious literature does expect the reader to be involved in a sense. I mean, you have to do your own work too. But it is not a chore if you are into it. It is a delight. But it's that. It's not comics with very long subtitles. It is something else. And it is also, I think, basically committed literature. That is to say, engaged. Now, this may sound very obscure. It's an old battle, committed literature against uncommitted literature. And in Europe, in France especially, they still get very hot under the collar about it. And in the U.S., it has never been really seriously treated. I mean, the most best-known critics and writers about other people's writing have always been, almost all of them without exception, been committed to uncommitted literature, if that doesn't sound too involved. They believe that true art is uncommitted, which you mean it sort of floats somewhere up in the stratosphere and doesn't deal with daily affairs. Now, as I hope I hope it's clear enough, because it is a complicated thought, this committedness, again, it's not brought in. Many novels, I remember several novels from post-war in which people try to give them more actuality by John and Mary are going to bed for the first time, but first they turn on the radio and guess what? Pearl Harbor has been bombed. That is not make it a committed novel. That's just a little gimmick to get people more interested, perhaps. Committedness is something quite different. But through the years, in this country especially, critics have argued for art's sake, uncommitted novel. Walter Goodman in the New York Times has several pieces of him have read in which he prizes our artistic freedom, and in which he tells that that means that true artists, between quotes, live outside and above the world of politics. And in the same breath, there's Louis Auchincloss, who's now a bit passé, I guess, but he was a very well-known critic. I hope he's still alive. He has pointed out to us that Henry James, the one of the very popular writers of the about early part of the 20th century, an American who went to England and became Brit, was naturalized as a Britisher, and who wrote long novels about rich people in Boston. Auchincloss points out that in all his very ample novels, there is never a thought about politics or economics. He was simply, Auchincloss tells us, and he was simply and totally a master of fiction. And worse, if you come to something really more political, there's Archibald MacLeish, who quotes in a famous article an editor of the Old Atlantic Monthly from way back before Bill Whitworth and Mr. Zuckerman. He quotes the Atlantic Monthly, which is the oldest American weekly, or perhaps the nation is the oldest, but they're both from mid-19th century. He wrote that a black novel could never be true art because by its very nature it had to be protest writing. That means committed writing. Now, you won't be surprised if I feel that the truth is closer to the very opposite, that protest writing, committed writing, only can produce a true novel of art. Our dean of the daily reviews in the New York Times, and believe me, they're important as far as any serious article still influences sales, and as long as you don't think of various talk shows with very depressing interviewers ask you about your book. I have suffered through that. Of course, one does it because you have to do something, otherwise you may as well become a cab driver. But the average reviewer on a talk show has not read your book. He has read the covered copy. And even if you go to the more serious ones, like Oprah, and they ask you to tell in a few sound bites what it was all about. So here you come with 400 pages, and you have worked on this for 10 years, and then this guy says, well, what is it about? And then like 5 minutes later, you're back in the audience, and you wipe off the makeup, and you know you have ruined your chance or whatever. But that's modern literary criticism. So we have here Lehman Haupt, who is the dean of the Daily New York Times guys, and he writes a friendly review and sometimes an unfriendly review of a novel, including mine. And then if he feels that its heroes and its anti-heroes are not neutral within their world, are not just fighting the problems they have because they can no longer make love to their mistress or because the dentist has run off with their wife, but if they are also worried about the state of the universe and the human race and so forth, he calls that tendentious. Tendentious. I looked it up when he last called a novel of mine tendentious, but the Nouvelle Dictionary says it means advancing a definite point of view. I'm afraid that's not what Christopher means, because that sounds very positive to me, and he means it negatively. The last time I talked to him, which was not long ago actually, I think he either has forgiven me my tendentiousness or just decided to forget about it, but he told me tendentiousness to him means if it pokes you with its elbow to make a point. Now, that I have sympathy with that. Of course, that would be, but I don't think that's tendentiousness. That's simply bad writing, and it is difficult. I feel in my own struggles of 40 years that I have really tried to come to. All my novels are political in the sense that they are tendentious, that they are what Christopher Lehman Haupt calls tendentious. But of course, one doesn't want to write a novel which has an obvious message. Like a Howard Fast novel, for instance, I don't particularly think that's very inspiring committedness. You have to struggle to get your message underground, so to speak. It has to come to the reader almost unknowingly. Trollope says Trollope says, first of all, that the writer who doesn't want to change the world and educate his public is not very interesting. It's not hardly worth talking about. But he also says that he has to hide this in the inside of a, you have to gild the lily or gild the pill or whatever the expression is, and you have to hide your message underneath, and that's what he does. It was extreme success because they are very soothing books, and I'm sure people will happily read them as entertainment. And they almost unknowingly they accept the criticism in his books of all the nonsense going on in the world and the frauds and the ballyhoo and the phoniness. You know, Oscar Wilde said a writer who doesn't have utopia on his map is not worth looking at. And that's a very nice way of summing it up. A lot of people have said nice things in favor of tendentiousness, including Lorca, who said it would be cruel if it weren't so obviously impossible to be neutral. Anyway, the simplest way to answer the argument is perhaps to say that every novel is tendentious, is committed, and that what a book critic may call an uncommitted novel is a novel which is committed to what I would think one of the most uninspiring of causes, committed to the status quo, committed to the idea that we live in the best of all possible worlds. Now, again, I do not mean to imply that the novel should grapple with social problems. It means that a serious novel should, as indirectly and subtle as possible, show that the author has gone through an awareness of the world and of the human condition. The idea that true, pure art may float in a vacuum, sort of above us all, is absolute nonsense, because it cannot be done. If you look at in another art form, if you look at Rembrandt, the painter of Amsterdam, who created beauty out of a very unbeauteous subject, like old shabby people in the streets of Amsterdam. Nevertheless, you can't think of him without realizing that, or without accepting is a better word, that he was anchored in a society, that his work, his whole approach to life, his Christianity, everything was anchored in a society which was made prosperous by the looting of the Dutch East Indies. And in the same way that the connoisseurs who sat at the Diaghilev Ballet and counted the entrechats, that particular sophistication of art appreciation depended on a style of life which was maintained by Indo-Chinese natives tapping rubber trees for 15 centimes a day. And if you look at Henry James's unpolitical heroes and heroines, you realize that if they have to go off to work every morning at 9 o'clock and worry about paying the mortgage, they would lose very much of their fascination. The fascination is really more based on the independent incomes than on Harry James's talent. The ivory towers of Western civilization are erected with the sweat and tears of our own and other nations' underdogs. That Price was probably right. It was right in the sense that it was historically unavoidable. But the pure fiction, so beloved by Lewis Auchincloss, would by its very purity tend to hide and to continue the great injustices of our past. I'm not finding fault with Jane Austen for ignoring the riots of the weavers in England at the time, who were suddenly found themselves starving because of machines. And I'm not finding fault with her for ignoring the battles of Waterloo and the Battle of Leipzig and the great dramas of the Napoleonic Wars, all that in favor of marriage expectations of her heroines, because she was a writer within her time, a time which, in the words of Saint-Just, the French revolutionary, had witnessed the invention of human happiness, and a time which had discovered the individual. When Jane Austen dwells on expectations of her persons, which she always expresses in pounds sterling per annum, then she was also writing all the same about free will and about loneliness and death. She was creating an art of fiction for people who had just come upon their own individualities and the highs and lows of each man and woman's own unique destiny. And it is this cult of the individual which characterizes the 19th century as much as the coal and the steel and the Industrial Revolution. And you could argue that her novels are more precisely engaged to the essence of her time than if she had written about Napoleon. And if you don't find fault with her, you shouldn't find fault with Kafka. Kafka, too, the first time I discovered this, my great surprise, hardly mentions the outbreak of World War I in his diaries. He writes more about his engagement to his fiancée. Now, this does not mean that he was not a seriously committed writer. I think he was more seriously committed than the writer who might seem the neck plus ultra of committedness, a guy now largely forgotten perhaps, Henri Barbusse, who before Remarque and All Quiet on the Western Front wrote a novel called Le Feu, translated here as Under Fire, which was a very drastic and down-to-earth description of the war in the trenches. But Barbusse did not see those trenches as a fatal result of what was wrong with our society. He describes them as a diabolical adventure, and as a thing of once in a not just in a lifetime, perhaps once in the life of humanity. And Kafka wrote about the nation machines, about the dehumanized bureaucracy, and that was precisely the thing that drove the people to the trenches in the first place. And it was precisely that the thing which became the most crucial and the most signifying and the most typical of the wrongness of the 20th century, of what went wrong in our century. So here you see that subject is not what decides committedness. It's decided by the direction of the commitment of the writer. Now, on top of this comes a connection, which is that America, which is of course is politically very different from Europe in its way it looks at ideology and so on, that American writers and American readers, I assume, only use the words committed and tendentious when the writers, the persons in the novel, be they heroes or heroines or anti-heroes, when they are fighting the human condition as is, when they go against the American grain, as Dwight MacDonald called it. If you look at, if you pick a dozen recent whodunits, I think you will find that most of them, if not all of them, are as elbow in the ribs politicizing as any book by a man like Henry Kissinger. I have an example, for instance, Gorky Park, which was a very, and is still a best-selling whodunit, and which was very strongly praised by Chris Lehmann-Hauff, for instance. It's a thriller set in Moscow, obviously, and it presents a caricature of the movement of the 60s, which those of you who are old enough to remember may think of with very positive feelings. Anyway, not with feelings of ridicule. Gorky Park delivers a caricature of the movement. It writes about a march of protesters along 125th Street. And what are they protesting? Not the war, not racial inequality, not any of those things we did protest about, and with very good reason. They protest because the police has arrested a black rapist. Now, we all know that that's total nonsense, and it's meant as a caricature. So this politicizing confirms our established national truth on the division of good guys and bad guys in the world. And books are earmarked as harmless, pure entertainment, which accept the traditional division. Now, this makes it very much of a challenge to those of us who are somewhat doubtful about the truth of national truth of any country. Hans Koning. This was the first of what we hope will be many programs called Literary Discord. Thank you for listening, and I very much hope you will listen again.